My name is Noah, and this is my story. If you're hearing this, you are my descendant, and I'm about to tell you why. Picture this. The world has been struck by an unimaginable catastrophe, leaving only my family and me as the last survivors. It's surreal. Everyone is gone except for us. The scale of destruction is beyond comprehension, and the loss of life is utterly devastating. I can't help but wonder what went wrong and how everything unraveled so quickly. This is judgment beyond measure. How did this happen? Many forces came together to bring about the Great Flood. The sequence of events that led to the flood began with the creation of the sons of God. Even before the world itself was made, these sons of God were believed to possess supernatural powers and were regarded as divine beings. However, it is said that one of these divine beings rebelled against God and became a fallen being, setting the stage for the catastrophic events that would follow. Heaven was originally intended to be their home for all eternity, but now they had fallen from it. What caused all of this? Angels are celestial beings created with the sole purpose of dwelling in heaven with God. Their primary function is to worship Him and execute His orders. They were designed to glorify God and serve as messengers between Him and humans. Unlike humans, who were created to live on earth, the angels were meant to live in heaven. These celestial beings, known as angels, decided to abandon their origin in heaven. They departed from their starting point and ventured into our world with their own agenda. They left their beginning in the Garden of Eden, a paradise where Adam and Eve could live in peace and harmony. Satan launched his first attack on God's authority on earth. Adam and Eve fell and were cursed, and even now, my family still suffers greatly from that curse. You see, farming and survival are very difficult. The Lord said, "Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return." Now my ancestors and I have had to sweat to survive. God was disappointed because of their disobedience. They could no longer stay in Eden. Adam and Eve had already made a mistake by eating the forbidden fruit. As a consequence of their disobedience, God was filled with disappointment, and Adam and Eve were no longer permitted to remain in the idyllic paradise that was the Garden of Eden. The fatal error resulted in their expulsion from the serene sanctuary they once called home. Adam and Eve had sons and daughters, including Cain and Abel. As their family grew, the birth of civilization itself began. As the children of Adam and Eve grew, they took wives and started their own families. The population began to increase steadily. Cain killed his brother and started a very malevolent and dangerous lineage that did not call on the name of God. Fortunately, Eve gave birth to my ancestor Seth, and the world began a godly lineage through him. Humanity was divided into two paths, the lineage of Cain and the lineage of Seth. As the world's population grew, so did the prevalence of sin. People were often cruel to each other, and their actions were filled with deceit, theft, and even murder. During this era, men were blessed with extraordinarily long lives, sometimes lasting hundreds of years. It was a different era, a time when humanity was still intimately connected to its origins and the world itself was younger and fresher. Adam, the first man, lived 930 years, yes, you heard that right, 9 centuries. He had children who also lived extraordinarily long lives. His son Seth lived 912 years, and Seth's son Enosh lived 905 years. As generations passed, each man fathered children and taught them the ways of the land, how to till the soil, care for animals, and also how to connect with God. This lineage of people was special. They carried the seed of the first union of humanity with fallen angels. Despite their long lives and deep wisdom, these early people were not immune to the problems that frequently plague humanity, issues like jealousy, anger, and sometimes even violence. However, there was a man, my great-grandfather, named Enoch, is the man who never died in the history of my family. My great-grandfather had a deep and sincere appreciation for the love of God, which he expressed through his unwavering loyalty and fervent passion. As a result of his devotion, he became a channel for God's mighty power and was blessed with great manifestations of that power throughout his life. Interestingly, my great-grandfather's faith was so strong that he was often able to prophesy future events with remarkable accuracy. In fact, he even spoke about the future judgment of the Lord against the people long before it happened. Enoch always prophesied about the coming judgment of the Lord against the people, When Enoch was 65 years old, he became the father of Methuselah, my grandfather. Methuselah's life might have foreshadowed mine because his name meant, when he dies, it will happen. As the years passed, communities of tribes and clans emerged, each tracing its ancestry back to one of the original patriarchs. These groups of people ventured across the lands, exploring new territories to call their own. As the number of people increased, so did their needs and aspirations. The traditional roles of shepherding and farming were no longer enough to sustain their livelihoods, and they began to explore new avenues. Families grew into tribes, and people began to take on different roles and professions, ranging from skilled craftsmen to scholars. These changes marked the first steps toward the evolution of civilization, as people began to organize themselves into complex social structures, with each person contributing their unique skills and abilities to the community. Now here we are, 10 generations since Adam. Life continues to present its challenges, for the earth remained severely hardened after Adam's curse. The men of our time find it increasingly difficult to obtain sustenance and provide for their families. My father Lamech lived 182 years and had me. He named me Noah, saying that I would bring comfort and relief to our people who toil painfully due to the curse of the soil. This is who I am. I was born with the purpose of bringing relief. The world is a malevolent place. The Nephilim have invaded the earth. Now picture this chaotic world. An unusual development occurs. The Nephilim were special, not like ordinary people. They were strong and larger than life, but they made the world's problems even worse. They were admired, feared, and even worshipped, leading people further away from the true God who created them. Their strength made them objects of fascination, but they were part of a world sinking deeper into chaos and sin. Evil legions began to infiltrate humanity. As the human population increased on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Who were these sons of God? As I mentioned before, they were fallen angels. These fallen angels descended to earth and gave birth to the Nephilim, or giants. The fallen ones corrupted the entire world. These rebellious angels lusted after human women and took them as wives. There were also giants on the earth in those days. Giants are the unnatural offspring of the union between the sons of God and the daughters of men. They were the mighty men of old, men of renown. This is the world I reside in, a world of giants and Nephilim, a world of wickedness. So the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. The earth was not a place of peace or goodness, but a place filled with sin, violence, and moral corruption. Imagine a dark world where individuals are consumed by their own insatiable desires, relentlessly pursuing their selfish agendas without regard for the well-being of others. Concepts like honesty, integrity, and kindness are not just undervalued, they are misunderstood. Instead, people resort to deceit and manipulation as the norm to achieve their goals. Society is characterized by a every man for himself mentality, where everyone is out for themselves, and the very foundation of the community is torn apart by selfishness and malevolence. In this environment, families are not sanctuaries of love and support, but battlegrounds of deceit and betrayal. Neighbors do not look out for each other, but seek to take advantage of one another. Governments are not institutions of justice, but instruments of power, maintaining the rule of the strong over the weak. It was in this context that God saw the wickedness of humanity, the spiritual and moral decline. God's sorrow over his creation was profound. Humanity, the jewel of his creation, had lost its way. Instead of living in harmony with one another and the world, people were consumed by violence, wickedness, and deceit. God looked upon his creation with deep sadness, a divine sorrow, a pain so profound that it transcended human understanding. Imagine a father heartbroken by the actions of a rebellious child, but infinitely amplified. And so in his great sorrow, God made a difficult decision. The Lord sought to destroy humanity, whom he had created from the face of the earth, not just man, but also the animals, the creeping things, and the birds of the heavens, for it grieved him deeply to see humanity sin, and he regretted having made them. God was upset by the actions of the people he made, and there was no other option left to heal the world that was plunging into chaos. The Lord's Spirit would not strive with man forever. Judgment was coming. Fortunately, I found grace in the eyes of the Lord. I was saved by an act of divine sovereignty. Every intent of the thoughts of man's heart was only evil continually. That says a lot. There was no aspect of human nature that was not corrupted by sin. The world was a place where the population was exploding at an alarming rate. Perversion had become common. Demonic activity was widespread. Constant evil resided in the heart of man, and corruption and violence were rampant. God was tired of this state of affairs. So God turned his gaze to me. I was a just man, very different from my generation. I had a close relationship with God and walked in his ways, unlike many others of my time. I remained untouched by the corruption and wickedness that plagued the world. My family and I did not engage in sinful unions with fallen angels. While I certainly cannot claim to be perfect like God, I made a sincere effort to follow his commands and live according to his will. My family and I followed the Lord's ways. My family consisted of three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. I obeyed God's commands to the best of my ability and understood them. So in the midst of a generation consumed by sin and debauchery, I stood out as a shining example of righteousness. My life was characterized by integrity, and I walked with God in a close and intimate relationship, much like my great-grandfather Enoch. While others indulged in the pleasures of the flesh, I found my joy in serving and obeying the Lord. Every moment of my life was a testament to God's love and faithfulness, and I cherished the opportunity to walk with Him every step of the way. God considered me righteous. The population of the earth was utterly corrupt, spiritually and morally rotten in God's eyes, and the earth was filled with violence, disrespect, outrage, aggression, and greed for power. Due to the corruption and violence on the earth and the extent of corruption, God told me that He would judge the wicked along with the earth. God said to me, "I intend to bring an end to all living things, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. Behold, I am about to destroy them along with the earth." This pointed to a deep and serious problem in the world at that time. In times of great corruption and impending judgment, I received a divine message from God that was intended to save me and my family. Despite the dark circumstances, there was a glimmer of hope in the form of grace. Instead of completely wiping out humanity, God chose to preserve a small group of people, a remnant. I did not earn this grace, I stumbled upon it. Grace cannot be earned, but it can be discovered by anyone who seeks it. It is said that where sin abounded, grace abounded much more, and that was certainly true in my case. God said to me, "Make yourself an ark of cypress wood." God said, "Make for yourself," meaning this was my project. I was not to simply hire someone else to do it for me to prepare for the great flood. God instructed me to build compartments in it, including stalls, kennels, nests, cages, and enclosures to house all the animals and their provisions. To ensure the longevity of these structures, I was also instructed to coat the inside and outside of each compartment with pitch, a natural substance used to waterproof the wood. This proved to be an effective preservation method, as the ark was able to withstand the flood for an extended period. Perhaps the preservation of the ark serves a greater purpose, as a reminder of past judgment and a warning of future events. This is how you are to build it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, the width 50 cubits, and the height 30 cubits. That's about 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high, a structure as long as a 30-story building is tall. What's described isn't really a boat, but a well-ventilated barge meant just to float, not to navigate anywhere. After all, an ark is a chest, not a ship, referring to the boxy shape of the vessel. You shall make a roof for it, leaving an opening 1 cubit high all around the top. Put a door in the side of the ark and make lower, middle, and upper decks. The ark's shape resembled a box, but it was massive in size. Its upper part had an opening 1 cubit wide, measuring about 18 inches or half a meter. A window was constructed at the top of the ark, providing a view of the outside world. The window had a cover that could be opened and closed, allowing flexibility in controlling the amount of light and air entering the ark. As I began constructing the enormous ark, I couldn't help but wonder about the purpose of this colossal task. God simply instructed me to build the barge and that soon, He would bring judgment upon the earth. However, at that moment I had no idea what that meant. I couldn't imagine the purpose of this immense vessel. All I knew was that I had to trust in God's plan and follow His instructions. In the past, I received a divine message from the Lord that said, "You must build it." I followed the instructions and created what was necessary. Then the Lord shared with me the details of His plan. "Behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all life under the heavens in which there is the breath and spirit of life, everything on the earth shall perish. I was called to play a crucial role in the most significant judgment and greatest salvation the world had ever experienced. It was an extraordinary moment, filled with great responsibility and purpose. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark. Despite the dramatic judgment that was to come, God would make a covenant with me. God would also use me to save a remnant of every animal, so that the earth could be repopulated with people and animals after the flood. God then said, "Everything on earth will perish, but I will establish my solemn covenant with you. You shall enter the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you, and from every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female, of birds according to their kind, of animals according to their kind, of every creeping thing on the ground according to its kind. Two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. There was much food for me and all the animals. This would be the home for about 35,000 pairs of animals. Did you know that the average size of a land animal is actually smaller than a sheep? In fact, the ark would be large enough to carry an impressive total of 136,560 sheep in just half of its total capacity. This left ample room for all the other essential provisions like food, water, and shelter for both animals and humans. It's truly remarkable to think about the scale and capacity of such an incredible vessel. God made me the man of his counsel, communicating his purpose to destroy this wicked world by water. The secret of the Lord was with me, so I did according to all that God commanded me. I followed every instruction given by God with the utmost faith and obedience. I was devoted and committed to fulfilling God's will without hesitation or doubt. I encountered multiple obstacles along the way, making the process quite lengthy and demanding. I had the manpower. There was still my grandfather Methuselah and my father Lamech. The Lord said, "Of every clean animal you shall take with you seven pairs, the male and his female, and of animals that are not clean, two pairs, the male and his female. Also of the birds of the heavens, seven pairs, male and female, to keep their offspring alive on the face of all the earth. For in 7 days I will send rain on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights, and I will blot out every living thing that I have made from the face of the ground." And so I did everything the Lord commanded. When I received this daunting task, I simply obeyed. It required a tremendous amount of materials and years of effort, but I did not shy away from what God told me to do. I was a preacher of righteousness. I made public declarations to the people. It took me and my family a considerable amount of time, approximately 120 years, to complete the construction of the ark. During this extended period, I had the opportunity to interact with the people around me and share the purpose behind building the ark. Through my act of obedience, I also expressed my disapproval of the world's ways and embraced the inheritance of righteousness obtained through faith. It's a tragic story of disobedience and rebellion against the truth. Despite being warned about the impending danger, the people chose to ignore the message and refused to seek safety in the ark. During a time when disbelief was rampant, my message wasn't limited to verbal proclamations. The construction of the ark itself was a manifestation of my commitment to righteousness. Every hammer strike and every nail driven into the wood was a reminder to the people that they needed to repent and return to righteousness before it was too late. The ark was not just a physical structure, but a powerful symbol of the impending judgment to come. My contemporaries ignored the message that could have saved them. Everything continued as it always had. People feasting, drinking, exchanging wedding vows, and indulging in their own pleasures, all while disregarding the existence of God. But then the day came when I entered the ark, and the heavens opened with a torrent of rain that destroyed every living being who was too busy to heed the warning. For 120 years I dedicated my life to preaching righteousness to the masses, hoping to inspire change in their hearts and minds. But unfortunately, it seemed my words fell on deaf ears. Despite my efforts, my message appeared to go unnoticed and unheeded. I wonder if they would ever open their hearts and turn their gaze toward the path of righteousness that I so fervently tried to guide them to. I built the ark 1600 years after God created intelligent human beings capable of innovation. With life expectancies approaching 1,000 years, the achievements of the best innovators of the pre-flood world were remarkable. We could build cities, create musical instruments, and work with metals. My culture was at its industrial peak. While working on the ark, the task of constructing it was daunting, requiring immense physical effort, significant expense, and endless patience. The entire process was fraught with danger and uncertainty. To outside observers, it may have seemed foolish and absurd. I worked on the project for decades, even as those around me mocked and ridiculed my efforts. Despite all this, I remained steadfast in my faith and continued to build the ark, knowing it was my duty and destiny. My job was to obey God and trust Him to provide what I lacked, including the wisdom to build a sturdy vessel and complete the project on time. Can you imagine what it must have been like when the ark was finally completed? However, during that time, I lost my father. He would no longer be around for the judgment. After a few more years, even the prophet Enoch was gone. My ancestor Enoch would not join me on the journey, for he had been taken by God. His words should have been taken seriously, for he was taken from this life so that he would not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. My ancestors were gone. They would not face this cataclysmic event that I was about to face. Then the day came, the day that ended my entire generation. Most of my generation would end today. All those I grew up with would meet their fate today. So the Lord said to me, "Enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this generation." The idea is that God was in the ark and would be with me in the ark. So He called me to come into the ark with Him. The Lord did not tell me to go to the ark, but to come, clearly implying that God Himself was in the ark, waiting to receive me and my family into the great vessel that would be our place of refuge, while all others on the face of the earth would be drowned. It was a once-in-a-lifetime moment, one I would never forget. As I stood inside the ark, surrounded by the animals and the presence of God, the only people with me were my own family. Do you know what it's like to lose everyone you've known since childhood? I tried my best, I warned them for a long time. Today I would lose all the people who were not my immediate family. Today everyone would be judged. The air was filled with the sounds of thousands of creatures, each making its unique noise. After all these years of hard work, we had finally finished. In some animals, God created a migratory instinct that can operate in incredible ways. This was the largest and most complete menagerie ever gathered. Not by human skill, but only divine power could have accomplished such a task. Two by two, they entered the ark. God never has trouble making animals do what He wants. This was a very unique moment. My father was no longer here to witness this. He had died only 5 years earlier. Perhaps God waited for Enoch, Methuselah, and Lamech to pass away before bringing the flood. Now I am here without these men of faith. God even said that He saw that I was righteous. I spent the years before the flood in active obedience. Not only did I believe that God would send the flood, but I also obeyed what God told me to do in preparation for it. When I received the message to enter the ark, people looked and laughed every time they passed by. I could hear them starting to make silly, petty jokes about old crazy Noah. Everyone knows there's not going to be a flood of water. How could that be? However, the Bible says that a flood of water did come. The Lord shut me in. The same door that shut them out is the door that shut us in. The same waters that destroyed the world were the waters that lifted the ark. I was 600 years old when the floodwaters came upon the earth, covering all the land. Then I, my sons, my wife, and my sons' wives with me, entered the ark to escape the waters of the flood. Of clean animals and animals that are not clean, of birds and of everything that creeps on the ground, they came by God to the ark, two by two, male and female, as God had commanded me. And after the 7 days, God released the rain and the waters of the flood came upon the earth. In the 600th year of my life, on the 17th day of the second month, on that very day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows and floodgates of heaven were opened. It rained on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. The animals, my family, and I waited in the ark for 7 days for the rain. It was a true test of faith, waiting a week after over 100 years of preparation. Then the windows of heaven were opened. The fountains of the great deep burst forth. Waters rose from beneath the earth, accompanied by great geological catastrophes. It rained for 40 days and 40 nights. This was a time of testing and purification, especially before entering the new world. On that same day, I, along with Shem, Ham, and Japheth, my sons and my wife, and the three wives of my sons with them, entered the ark. They and every beast according to its kind, all the livestock according to their kinds, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth according to its kind, and every bird according to its kind, every bird of every sort, entered the ark. Two by two, all creatures that had the breath of life in them came to me and entered the ark. Those that entered were male and female of all flesh, as God had commanded me. And the Lord shut the door behind me. Everything was prepared just as the Lord had spoken. Everything was ready for the flood that God was about to bring upon the earth. I didn't have to shut the door on anyone's salvation. God did that. Normally, we handle the disqualification of individuals from salvation, but we must let God make that decision. God kept the door open until the last possible moment, but eventually it had to close. The door is either open or shut. For me, the ark was the ultimate salvation. But unfortunately, for the rest of the world, it meant condemnation. Those outside the ark had no further opportunities for redemption. After 120 years, the Spirit of God ceased to strive with humanity. Beyond that door, death reigned without exception, but inside there was absolute tranquility. The flood, the great deluge, rained 40 days and 40 nights upon the earth, and the waters increased and lifted the ark so that it floated high above the earth. The waters became powerful and greatly increased on the earth, and the ark floated on the surface of the waters. The waters prevailed so greatly and were so powerful and overwhelming on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heavens were covered. Indeed, the waters rose 15 cubits higher than the highest ground, and the mountains were covered. Every living thing that moved on the earth perished. Birds, livestock, wild animals, all the creatures that swarm over the earth, and all mankind. Everything on dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life died. God destroyed, blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the earth. Man and animals and the creeping things and birds of the heavens were destroyed from the earth. Only I and those who were with me in the ark remained alive. This was a global flood. It's hard to imagine how much rain fell as the mountains were completely covered. Despite the doubts and disbelief of many, God proved his faithfulness and fulfilled his promise. After 120 years, the flood lasted 150 days without receding. Secure in the ark during the catastrophe and judgment, my family and I were safe, locked in and sheltered from the storm and the flood. Then God remembered me and every living thing and all the animals that were with me in the ark. He was about to do something unique in our lives. God made a wind pass over the earth and the water subsided. God never forgot me. He sustained me daily in the ark. But at this point, God once again turned his active attention to me. It was truly as if he remembered me again. I had been locked in the ark for many days, and at the right moment God thought of me. In the face of a natural disaster like a flood, it's easy to feel powerless and overwhelmed. But we must not forget that the Almighty, who created the vast universe and our world, can calm even the most furious waters. His wisdom and power are beyond our comprehension, and he can overcome any obstacle, no matter how daunting it may seem. The force of nature may appear intimidating, but remember, nothing is impossible for the divine power that governs our world. As the floodwaters receded, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. Imagine this, a majestic mountain range, its northern and eastern slopes rising from the vast plain of the Aras River, towering at an impressive 3,300 meters above sea level. To the southwest, the slopes rise from a breathtaking plain at a dizzying height of 5,500 meters above sea level. With a diameter of approximately 40 kilometers, Mount Ararat is a true wonder of nature, capable of leaving anyone in awe of its beauty and grandeur. Ararat, the true cradle of humanity, our very own garden. The heavens roared with thunder as the fountains of the deep burst forth, and a flood of water swept over the earth. The rain fell relentlessly for 150 endless days, threatening to submerge all life. But then, miraculously, the waters began to recede, slowly revealing the long-lost contours of the world. Finally, on the 17th day of the 7th month, the ark came to rest on the majestic mountains of Ararat, a symbol of hope amidst the desolation. As the days passed, the waters continued to recede until, finally, on the first day of the 10th month, the stunning sight of the mountaintops emerged in the distance, signaling the return of life to the earth. The relentless rain finally ceased, but the power behind it was still evident. It was nothing less than the divine control of God deciding when the rain and other waters would go, and when they would stop. Mount Ararat was not an ideal location for disembarking from the ark. Leaving the ark in high altitude, mountainous terrain made the departure challenging for all of us. However, if God intended to place the ark in that specific location, it was the perfect place to leave it. The animals would be able to go in any direction from here as the floodwaters receded. As the waters receded, an impressive magnitude emerged. The peaks of mountains once hidden were gradually revealed. This massive global flood was so intense that the mountain peaks were initially submerged, hidden from sight. But as the water steadily diminished, the mountains finally came back into view, a testimony to the flood's force and relentlessness as it swept over the earth. After the passage of 40 days, I eagerly opened the window of the ark that I had worked so hard to build. With a sense of anticipation, I sent out a raven to explore the world beyond the ark. The raven flew back and forth, flapping its wings in the air until the waters dried up, and the earth was once again exposed. It seems that the raven can fly for a long time without needing to land, perhaps because it is a scavenger, and can rest and feed on floating dead carcasses. But these birds would not suffice. We needed to send out a bird that would return to us. After weeks confined in the ark, we finally decided to send a brave dove to see if the waters had receded. As she flew over the vast expanse of water, we anticipated her return, but unfortunately, the dove found no place to rest the sole of her foot and had to return to the ark. The floodwaters still covered the entire face of the earth. The suspense was unbearable. I reached out and pulled her back into the ark, holding her close to me. Then I waited anxiously for 7 long days before sending the dove out again. After her mission, the dove returned with a freshly plucked olive leaf in her beak. Now I knew that the waters had finally receded from the earth. What a sight, a dove with an olive leaf! Being a clean bird, not a scavenger, the dove would not land on the ground until there was dry and suitable land to perch on. The dove patiently waited for the right moment to land on dry, suitable ground, embodying the virtue of cleanliness and grace. But I wasn't finished yet. I waited another 7 days and sent the dove out again, and this time she did not return. I knew then that our journey had come to an end and that we had finally found dry land. The dove's failure to return signified that she had started her life anew on the earth. There it was. The raven and the dove were the first to begin their new lives on the new earth. Soon enough, the other animals would also begin their new lives. God had instructed me to enter the ark at a specific time, but he didn't tell me when to exit. It was necessary for me to know when to enter, and God made sure I knew that. However, it wasn't important for me to know when to leave, so God didn't reveal that to me. It happened that in the 601st year, in the first month, on the first day of the month, the waters were dried off from the earth. I removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the surface of the ground was dry. You can imagine the anticipation that filled my heart as I waited for the waters to recede. And then finally, after being confined in the ark for so long, it happened. However, we still remained inside the ark for a time. On the 27th day of the second month, the earth was dry. Moreover, God spoke to me, saying, "Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh, including birds, animals, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may breed abundantly on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." I went out, and my wife, my sons, and my sons' wives with me. Every animal, every creeping thing, every bird, and everything that moves on the earth went out of the ark by their families. As the floods raged, I had bravely entered the ark on the 17th day of the second month of my 600th year. For a full year, I battled the tempestuous seas until finally, in the second month of my 601st year, I emerged victorious from the ark, triumphant and alive. It was a year of significant change and upheaval, one that would shape history forever. Imagine that, the earth bursting forth with life as living creatures from the ark repopulate the planet, bringing back the vibrancy and diversity that were once lost. What a captivating scene. Emerging from the confines of the ark, I stepped out into the vast world, walking out, and the entire world lay before me. Upon choosing to honor God's covenant with me, I constructed a magnificent altar for the Lord and carefully selected only the purest and finest animals and birds to offer as burnt sacrifices. The flames leapt high into the sky as I humbly presented my offerings, my heart full of reverence for the Almighty. It was a truly awe-inspiring moment that left me deeply connected to God. The final test of faithfulness was about to be made. With only 7 of each animal on the ark, the stakes were high, but I knew what had to be done. I risked extinction by offering some of these animals, but I did so anyway because I knew that costly sacrifice is what pleases God the most. Are you ready for an exciting challenge? To truly honor and connect with God, we must be willing to make sacrifices that cost us something. We are called to give generously of our resources and offer the sacrifice of praise to Him. So let's take on the challenge and experience the thrill of giving our all to God. When it comes to pleasing God, it's not about giving Him just anything. It's about giving sacrificially at great cost. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, a soothing and satisfying scent. And the Lord said to Himself, "Never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though the inclination of his heart is evil from his youth. And never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease." The extravagant offering brought immense joy to God. It was almost as if the taste of the roasted meat filled the air, triggering an intense feeling of satisfaction in God's heart. He was so pleased that He made a magnificent promise to me and all humanity. God promised that He would never again destroy all living creatures on earth with a flood of such scale as He did before. He made this promise out of pure mercy, knowing that the inclination of man's heart is toward evil from his youth. Man would still sin, but God decided to spare humanity from such a cataclysm. Behold, the Almighty poured out His blessings upon me and my sons, commanding us to go forth and multiply, spreading our seed and filling the earth with our descendants. The Lord also said, "And the fear of you and the dread of you will be upon every beast of the earth, upon every bird of the air, upon all that moves on the ground, and upon all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hands. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. But you must not eat meat that still has its lifeblood in it. The world was nothing like I had known before." With God's renewed mandate, it was a new beginning, a fresh start, and the possibilities were endless. This is like when God said to Adam, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and every living thing that moves on the earth." God said to Adam, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food." However, now I was given specific permission to eat animals. God also commanded that if animals were killed and eaten, there should be proper respect for the blood. Blood is vital. Blood is the essence of life, so it's no wonder it deserves the utmost respect. Whether it's the blood of an animal or a human, it symbolizes the very core of existence. When we shed blood, we are taking life itself. It's not about superstition or mysticism. It's about acknowledging the sanctity of all life. Some practice the consumption of blood, but that was not the way of the Lord. The Lord said, "Surely I will require an accounting for your lifeblood. I will demand an accounting from every animal, and from each human being too. I will demand an accounting for the life of another human being. Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made mankind. As for you, be fruitful and multiply, spread abundantly on the earth and multiply in it." According to God's command, if someone's blood was shed, there should be an investigation into the matter. This is because God created man in His own image, and therefore, human life is inherently valuable and cannot be taken without accountability before God. The words, "by humans shall their blood be shed," carry a powerful message. They remind us that life is precious and must be protected at all costs. When a heinous crime like murder is committed, God says the perpetrator deserves nothing less than the maximum punishment, the death penalty. See the force of God's command. He even demands an accounting for human life from every animal. God does not tolerate the unlawful killing of any kind. Be fruitful and multiply. This point was repeated for emphasis, and it was because the situation was critical. Our planet desperately needed to be repopulated, and we were the only ones who would ensure the continuation of our species. God makes a covenant with man and with all creation. Then God spoke to me and my sons, saying, "Now behold, I am establishing my covenant, a binding agreement, a solemn promise with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and the wild animals of the earth along with you, everything that came out of the ark, every living creature on earth. I will establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be destroyed by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth." God made a promise that He would never again destroy the world with a flood. That's right. The Almighty made this promise as a repetition and clarification of His previous covenant. God didn't believe He had done anything wrong or too severe by sending the flood. He made a promise to ensure that the same wicked conditions that existed in the pre-flood world would never be repeated exactly. And God said, "This is the sign, the visible symbol, the memorial of the solemn covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you, for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth. God said to me, "This rainbow is the sign of the covenant, the solemn promise, the binding agreement that I have established between me and all living creatures on the earth." Yes, the promise was even made to the earth itself, because the canopy of water vapor was released during the flood, and the water cycle of the earth changed after the flood. This may have been the first emergence of a rainbow. God used the rainbow as a sign to me in all generations that he would be faithful to his covenant. And there it was, the first rainbow. Can you imagine witnessing the first rainbow to ever appear on our planet? And what's even more exciting is that God chose this magnificent creation as a sign of his faithfulness to me and all the generations that followed. The rainbow is also a promise to you. When you see a rainbow, remember my epic story. Whenever we spot a rainbow, it serves as a powerful reminder of God's unshakable promise and the fulfillment of all his commitments. Indeed, it assures us that his covenant of peace with humanity is as unbreakable as his covenant with me and all subsequent generations. All of this came with its challenges. I no longer had a peer. I was the oldest man alive. Everyone else was dead, and soon, something very sad was about to happen that would affect my children and their descendants. My sons who emerged from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and from these men the whole earth would be populated and dispersed with inhabitants. My sons would be the foundation of the world. Canaan, my grandson, would be cursed as a result of what transpired after that catastrophe. I faced the aftermath of the catastrophic flood and emerged into a completely new world, determined to build a new life for myself and my loved ones. With boundless energy and enthusiasm, I threw myself into an exciting adventure of exploration and discovery, planting a multitude of crops, including a magnificent vineyard that promised to produce an abundant harvest. I used the grapes to make wine. After drinking the wine, I became drunk and lay uncovered in my tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, accidentally saw my nakedness, and to my shame, he told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it across their shoulders, and walked backward to cover my nakedness. Their faces were turned away so that they would not see their father's nakedness. Ham is said to have gleefully told what he observed in my tent. He decided to mock me, his father, and in the process was undermining my authority as a man of God. Ham's response showed his lack of respect for me. When I awoke from this wine-induced stupor, I knew what my youngest son, Ham, had done to me. So I said, "Cursed be Canaan, the son of Ham. A servant of servants he shall be to his brothers." I also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." The judgment was severe. Canaan would live in servitude to Shem. However, this was not the end of evil in the world. After years of populating the earth, a man named Nimrod was born, and this changed everything we understood. Nimrod was born into a new world, recently recreated by God after his judgment had left the old world devoid of much of human and animal life. Nimrod founded two of the most powerful empires in history. Nimrod's actions led many people away from God. God's will for me and my descendants was to populate the earth, but as one people gathered on the plain of Shinar, they had no interest in reaching the world to settle it. They had no interest in tending to the world that God had majestically placed before them. Instead, they rebelled. In this statement, we see that the people's will was opposed to God's will for them. This shouldn't surprise us, as humanity will always oppose God's will for them, except by saving grace through faith in Jesus Christ. However, the passage clearly teaches that the Lord's will always prevails, and he is not thwarted by humanity's efforts to challenge it. Nevertheless, their attempts were frustrated by the Lord. It wasn't difficult for the Lord to stop the progress of the Tower of Babel. The Lord dispersed the people over the face of the earth and made them stop building the city, because the Lord confused the language of the entire world. Imagine how incredible it must have been for the people, how surprised they must have been when God appeared and scrambled their languages. For God, it was a simple thing. His will and plans cannot be stopped. After 3 centuries since the Great Flood, my time in this world is coming to an exhilarating end. With all that said, who am I in practice? I am an example of a life of faith. By faith, being warned about things not yet seen, with holy fear, I built an ark to save my family. By faith, I condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. I didn't need to test God before taking action. When God spoke, I didn't need to hesitate or question Him. This was typical of my life. I was part of the godly line of Seth, of whom it was said, "At that time people began to call upon the name of the Lord." I was the result of generational obedience and faithfulness to God. In other words, be right with God, be right with others, and have a reverent, worshipful relationship with God. Behold, the Lord Almighty has the power to deliver the righteous from all kinds of trials and tribulations, and as I reflect on my life, it serves as a stark reminder that sin will not go unpunished. The day of reckoning is swiftly approaching. My name is Noah, and this is my story.